Hi, this is David Sachs, and welcome to Spiritual Tools for an Outrageous World. Every week we do a little couples therapy between us and God. It's a chance to deepen and explore our most important relationship.
Hi, I'm glad you're here. I'm excited to discuss the subject of sacrifices, korbonos, in the Torah. And it's something that's so kind of abstract for us, like bringing animals to atone for our sins. Like, what is going on? And animals, by the way, were expensive. So you have different levels of animals. Like, you had real, like, big animals, like bulls. Those were thousands of dollars by today's standards. And then you had other things, like birds, for people who weren't in a position to afford something like a bull. And then even birds were expensive. So you had just pancakes, just made out of flour. And by the way, whatever you brought was equally precious to God. And depending on what you brought was just kind of like what your economic circumstances were. There's a life force element to money, because you make money by exerting yourself. Someone said to me, use the word, which I took issue with, that if someone were to bring a bull, that would be ostentatious. That's a fancy word. That means very showy. Like, look at me, I'm bringing a bull, right? And I explained to the person, it's not ostentatious if that person has that level of cash. It's appropriate, because that's what they have to do in order to effect the proper energy transfer. So just so you understand the economics of korbonos, because the economics are based in spiritual truths. And so all of the sacrifices, all of the offerings, or we'll use the word korbonos from now on. By the way, korbonos is a very special word. In Hebrew, the word korbonos comes from the root karov. Karov means to be brought close. So that's important to keep in mind in this discussion, because being brought close was the whole essence of this process. It was really ultimately about connecting with God. And that's an important kind of thing to keep in mind in any discussion that we're going to have ever about the Torah. Because the purpose of the mitzvahs is really to make that divine connection. And a lot of times, like the Kotzker Rebbe said it most dramatically, which is that a person could even turn mitzvahs into idol worship. That seems like impossible, because it seems like mitzvahs are the opposite of idol worship. How does one become the other? So the idea is that if the entirety of your focus is just on the performance of this act, and you don't see it as a means to connect to God, then you're missing the entire point, and you can even make idol worship out of a mitzvah. I always like to think of it in terms of sports, oddly enough. Not that I know anything about golf or baseball, but this much I know, that if you really want to hit a home run, that it's not just about hitting the ball, this is for golf and baseball, it's about the follow-through of the swing. Every coach will tell you that. Every great player, and if you even watch games, like, the announcers will say, look at that follow-through. And that's what happens seemingly after you hit the ball. So the follow-through is what really, like, propels something to the next level. Now, why am I bringing that up in terms of mitzvot? Because it's not just the performance of the act itself. It's the follow-through. In other words, I am doing this act as a way of connecting to you, God. That's the follow-through moment. That's what elevates the entire experience. Now, interestingly, the name of this week's parsha is Tzav. Tzav are the letters that are in the middle of the word mitzvah. So mitzvah is, for better or for worse, translated as a commandment. That's not incorrect, but it will give you a very warped view of what Judaism is all about if you just translate the word mitzvah as commandment. This is the reason, by the way, or one of the reasons why we fast to this day, once a year, that the Torah was ever translated into another language. Because when you translate the Torah, every single word in the Torah has a phenomenal number of different meanings. And when you just pick one meaning out, you've already created your own personal commentary on the Torah itself. Listen to that thought again. My brother-in-law told me this for the first time years and years ago. It never left my consciousness. Every translation of the Torah is a commentary on the Torah. And again, why? Because every single word of the Torah can be translated 5, 10, 15, 20, 30, 100 different ways. And as the translator, you have to pick one of those words to translate, which means that you are superimposing your own limitation on the infinity of the Torah. That's going to be rooted in your own understanding, which by definition is going to be limited, since the Torah is unlimited and we are limited. So sometimes it's not tragic. You basically have communicated the essence. And sometimes you've horribly warped the essence. So Judaism really is an amazing love affair between us and the world, us and God, God and the Jewish people, God and all of his creations. The binding factor is love. And so when you say, well, what is Torah Judaism? Well, there's 613 commandments. All of a sudden, I'm like, what? Where did the love go? I thought we were talking about love a second ago. Now, all of a sudden, it's about this ruler pointing a finger at me and telling me what to do. So this is the tragedy of translation. However, having said that, there is an element of command. In other words, that is not absent from the word. That is an element of the word. But the heart of the word mitzvah is this word tzav, which means to connect. And we don't just connect to the mitzvah itself, but to God, and we use the mitzvah as a way to merge, to join. So I'll give you another translation for the word mitzvah. Reb Shlomo translated mitzvah, you ready for this? As a divine pathway. How's that for a translation? A divine pathway. So now we're getting deeper. And by the way, just while we're on the subject, halacha has another sort of like thunderously tone-deaf translation. Like mitzvah, halacha is translated as Jewish law. But the word halacha really means the way, the path, right? It comes from the word holech, which means to walk. So in other words, there's almost much more of an, almost like an Eastern religious feel to this idea of the word halacha. And yet again, people can use this word halacha like a hammer to hit you over the head with. Again, it's real, and we're commanded to go by it. But you understand that that there are pathways. There actually are pathways in creation. There is an order to creation, as chaotic as creation appears. You see, this is a larger subject, but creation itself is not chaotic at all. At all. Creation is phenomenally, mind-bendingly precise. Do you know what's chaotic? Human beings are chaotic. Creation is not chaotic. Creation is incredibly precise. And so when people say that everything is random, what do they really mean? They don't mean, because if you look at the planets obey very exact orbits, subatomic particles, very, very exact, right? So when people say things are random, what do they really mean? They mean, I don't understand you. Why did you do that? They mean that people themselves are confounding. And then they take the confusion of human interactions and then they project it on the universe itself and they say everything is random. But this simply isn't the case. And why are people so confounding and mysterious and baffling? Because we have free choice. There are a million, billion different ways to do absolutely everything. My favorite example that I've been giving lately, in the room that I'm speaking in right now, there's a pole right here. And you say, okay, I'm going to walk to this pole, which is about 5 feet in front of me. And then when I give this demonstration, I get to about 4.5 feet in front of the pole. And then I make an about face and I walk out the door onto Pico Boulevard. There are a million ways to do absolutely everything. You can get so close and then you just go off in another crazy direction. So what is halacha? By the way, we're still talking about halacha. What is halacha? Halacha says that in this world where you can go in a zillion different directions, there actually is a divine pathway. There actually is a divine pathway to do things. And that's actually amazing. That's amazing. Because now, if you're talking to me, if I'm standing in the middle of an open desert and I have no idea which direction to walk in, no idea, I'm in the middle of a vast open desert, and you say to me, there is a way to go to get what I want, I'm begging you to tell me the way. You don't have to command me. You don't have to command me. You mean there's a way? There's a way through this desert? There's a way through this labyrinth we call life? And it's provided by the one who made the labyrinth itself? I will run to be first in line. Please tell me. That's halacha. That's what halacha is. And then when I walk down that pathway, I get to connect to my creator. Those are mitzvahs. Now everything becomes completely reframed. Okay. So why did I tell you all of that? Because we're talking about korbonos. And what I'm telling you is that the root of the word korbonos, which can get kind of gnarly if you think about it. I mean, we're talking about like slitting the throats of animals and putting them on a fire and things like that. But we can't lose sight of what the root of the word is, because otherwise you're going to get lost in the woods. Karov, closeness, connecting. That's the big picture. So now, I want to communicate to you an understanding that comes from Kabbalistic sources. I learned this in the Pesachei Sharim, and I'm going to give it over to you in my words. I'm going to try to explain it to you in a way that's understandable. Afterwards, I'm going to give you in more shorthand the technical Kabbalistic terms that underpins what I'm telling you right now. But first, hear it, because otherwise you're going to get lost in the details and you might not follow the Kabbalah of it all, okay? Because it's a little technical if you're not familiar with the terms. And let me just give one more preamble to this. One of the interesting, let's say, challenges of learning Torah is that a lot of Torah that you learn is so spectacular that you're sort of wowed and blinded by the pyrotechnics of the thought, especially if it involves some gematria or something else. You can't believe that all these things fit together in such a resonant, amazing way. And so the downside of that, it sounds like, well, how could there be a downside of that? That's just the glory and depth of Torah. But there is a downside to that, that I've discovered anyway. The downside to that is you get so blinded by the showmanship of the thought itself that you don't have a chance to actually contemplate what's really being said. And sometimes it won't even occur to you to ask because you're just so, it's so breathtaking, the thought itself. So you say, but then if you're lucky, if you're serious, over a period of years, you keep on going back to these things and you go, but what does it mean? What does it mean? What does it actually say? And then new gates open up to you. And then you're able to actually connect with the thought itself. Imagine falling in love with a supermodel. And then sometime into the relationship, she says, yeah, but you don't, you're, I believe that you're in love with me. I believe that you're in love with me. But you don't know me. So, anyway, for better or for worse. So there's this thought that I learned that's really on this level of beauty. And I wanted to give it over yesterday. And I realized that it's way too technical. Like, I don't have time and I don't have a blackboard. I'm not going to be able to communicate it in a way that the people are going to understand. And so then I asked myself, well, what does it actually mean? Why don't you just tell them what it actually means? And it was such a wonderful moment for me because then I made a breakthrough on this subject of sacrifices. Okay, so now I can actually explain it in a real way, to the best of my ability. So it goes like this. Life is very sticky. Life is very sticky. As society progresses, we make certain improvements. And sometimes we look back on the improvements that we've made and we laugh at them because they seem so primitive. But when in their time, they were actually improvements. So the thing I was thinking about was, those of you who are old enough to remember this, there used to be a time when you'd walk into, say, a donut shop, and they'd have yellow pest strips hanging from the ceiling. And there would be dead flies, like large dead flies, hanging from these strips in the middle of the bakery shop. And you walked in and you went, wow, this is a really wholesome, clean place. Meanwhile, they have on display for everyone who walks in the corpses of like dead insects. But in its day, what it was communicating to the customer was, look, they're over here. They're not on your food. And so you felt really good about the fact that they were hanging on the no-pest strip as opposed to like crawling and dancing on your donut, right? So that's just a historical aside, but I'm using that to just illustrate the stickiness of life. Because, like I say, the situations that we find ourselves in, part of ourselves gets absorbed into those situations and gets left behind. Now, I'll give you a positive version of this. Kabbalistically, we say that a little of your soul goes into your possessions. This is a real thing. And one of the sort of more interesting things I ever saw in my life, by the way, was I was at a wedding, and it was at the time where people were kind of sitting at tables before the actual wedding itself. And I saw that there was a lot of excitement. This was a number of years ago. People were passing around something, and wherever this thing that people were passing around went, like the person got very, very excited who held it. And what I found out later on was it was a shirt from the Lubavitcher Rebbe, a white shirt. And so this idea that a little bit, like if you're a tzaddik or something like that, then this is like a very exalted thing that a little bit of you goes into your possessions. That's something. That's really something. Okay. Let me go a little bit deeper. There are people who save up and they get really nice cars. And nothing wrong with that. But a little of themselves goes into the car. Like, have you seen my car? So what's that code for? Have you seen me? That's what that's code for, right? People lose themselves in terms of their property, their house. Like, let me show you around my house. Translation, glory in me. I'm not being very charitable right now, but what I'm trying to say is that part of you gets stuck in your possessions. But what happens? Let's go to the other extreme now. And now we're getting more into the nitty-gritty of the korbonos, okay? What happens when I do something wrong? What happens when I do something that I'm not supposed to do? Then a little bit of myself goes in that thing. And now here's the question. How can I get myself back? Because I don't want little pieces of me floating around in those places. I want to remain whole. I want myself back from that situation. How do I get myself back? And this is what the korbonos were meant for. It was a way to disentangle your soul from the mistakes that you made. I'll say that again. It was a way to disentangle your soul from the mistakes that you made. Now, let me just put it in Kabbalistic terms, okay? And if you don't follow this, that's okay. But for those of you who do, you'll actually hear it laid out in a very formalistic way, what I just told you. This dimension that we live in is called Ban. Okay? Ban is really a gematria. It's the number 52. And interestingly, 52 is the gematria of the word behema. Behema means beast. Behema is the thing that we would bring for a korban. That's what we would put on the altar. We would put this beast. Isn't that fascinating that the name for this dimension that we live in has the same gematria, the same spiritual DNA signature as behema, as beast, because we live in a very physical, materialistic world. That's the nature, that's the signature of this world. Now, the world above this world Kabbalistically goes by the name Ma. Ma is also the gematria of the word Adam, which is a human being. That's the relationship between the soul and the body. The soul should be in the driver's seat. That's the idea of Ma being in the realm above Ban. Now listen to this. In the word behema, beast, which stands for this world, is also the word ma, which is the gematria Adam, the gematria of a person. And this is what the korbonos were meant for. It was a way to disentangle your soul from the mistakes that you made. That's how it works on a Kabbalistic level. You're taking the ma of behema, which is Adam, which is you, and you're lifting it back up to where it belongs, which is the realm above materiality. Because that's where your essence lies. Just like the soul should be above the body, meaning who is in the driver's seat of your decisions, right? Is it the horse or is it the rider? Does the horse tell the rider where it's going? Or does the rider tell the horse where it's going? Ma again means Adam. That's the world above our world. That means the soul is above the body. And ultimately, by the way, you want them mixed together. You want to bring that light of the higher world down into this world. But you want to do it in a way that's the proper path. This gets back to halacha and mitzvahs again. You want to bring that higher light down into this world, but in a sanctified way. Remember, Torah embraces physicality. Jews and eating, you know, I don't have to go any further than that. There is no problem with eating. There is no problem with enjoying. There is no problem with intimate relations. All of these things are sanctified and are part of our life. But there's the pathway to do it. And when we do it in that pathway, we bring the higher light down to this world. When we do it in a way that's sort of like more instinct driven, then we get entangled. Then we get entangled in this world. And so this is when I say to you, like, if I'm standing in the middle of a vast desert and I have no idea which direction to walk in, I'm begging you to tell me which way to go. Like, if you were to tell me I'm in the middle of the desert, and the person says, if you go that way, there's an oasis that way. You'll be able to eat and drink and sleep and restore yourself. Would I say, what are you telling me what to do for? What are you ordering me around for? No one in their right mind is going to react like that. Right? But you have to get to that place. You have to understand that this is coming, that all these things are coming. This guidance is not coming from human beings. This guidance is coming from the architect and the creator of the universe and of each of us. There's a religion which became very popular about 2,000 years ago. And they came to the conclusion that the mitzvahs were too difficult to keep. And I heard a rabbi say, but the one who created the mitzvahs is the one who created us. So what do you mean they're too difficult to keep? The one who created us is the one who created the mitzvahs. He knows exactly what we're capable of doing. Okay, it doesn't mean that there aren't challenges, and it doesn't mean we don't make mistakes, and it doesn't mean we don't have good days and bad days. Oh, that's also true. But the premise that it's too difficult is completely fallacious. It makes no sense. Because the one who created it created us. So now let's get back to this idea that there were different levels of korbonos. I told you that you could bring a bull. That would be a major check that you're right. If you're bringing a bull. You could also bring birds. By the way, something so beautiful about the birds, because that was kind of like someone who just had like a tiny bit of cash, which was maybe the majority. If a person was really more or less penniless, they would bring just like a flour pancake. That was, and they were all, God goes out of his way to say, they're all equally precious and equally holy. But I want to say something that I think is just beautiful about the birds, if you brought birds. You wouldn't pluck the birds. Normally with the larger animals, you would skin the animals. So you would say, well, if you brought a bird, you should pluck the bird because the feathers are the skin. So it should be consistent. But again, I really like this. I really think this is beautiful. If you pluck the feathers off a little bird, there's nothing left. And so look how God guards our honor. that we shouldn't be before the altar giving some scrawny, tiny little offering. That God says, okay, yeah, it's true, technically speaking, let's be consistent and take off the skin, which would be the feathers. But you know what? My larger concern is your honor. So let's make sure that when you give that offering, that you feel good about what you're giving. So everything has to do with your intention behind the thing itself. And of course, these offerings were so real that historically they became abused. Where people started, like the way we started off by saying, like the Kutzker Rebbe warned, that you can even turn mitzvahs into avodah zarah, into idol worship. That people felt like, if I just bring the offering itself, I've basically done the fixing. And you see that there really was a tremendous soul fixing that would be transacted, like an amazing spiritual remedy that we don't have anymore with these offerings. To reclaim yourself, to detangle your soul out of events and mistakes and all sorts of things like that. But you also have to apologize. Can you imagine like someone steals money from you? And you realize that you've been stolen from, and you're like, hey, that's really not cool. Wait, you stole from me? And then all of a sudden you get an email thing. $10,000 has been transferred to your Wells Fargo account via Zelle or Venmo or something like this. And the person never apologizes. It's like, no, cool, I get it. You gave me the money back. But what about our relationship? Does our relationship not mean anything to you? And so there are different aspects of the korbonos themselves. One of them was called a korban chatas. That would be translated as a sin offering. So there are certain major things that we don't want to do, but maybe we did by accident. Like I broke Shabbos. Okay, so if I broke it by accident, then I can repair that. I would bring something called a korban chatas. And what it says is that would restore the divine light coming from above to below. In other words, through certain actions of mine, I can limit the light emanating from the higher realms down into this world. So the korban chatas, this sin offering, would make the light flow again, as it had before I had done this mistake. Now you have something else, a korban ola. A korban ola was different. Now a korban chatas, you would put it on the altar, and then the kahanim would eat from it after it was like a holy barbecue. Like after it was cooked, they would eat from it. And by the way, interestingly, when was the atonement complete? So you could think, well, there's a whole series of steps with bringing a sacrifice. I don't know when the atonement would be complete. Well, I'm going to tell you. When the Kohen finished eating the korban. In other words, when a mistake all of a sudden now became something that benefited materially someone else, that's when the atonement was complete. Right? When actual good, tangible good flowed into the world. Very interesting, no? So now let's get back to this idea of the korban ola. Korban ola is different now. No one ate from the korban ola. You would put it on the altar, and the entire thing would go up in flames. Now, interestingly, the Gemara explains the following. That's the next step in the restoration of a relationship. The first step is to appease the other person. So in the example that we gave back before, I zelled you $10,000. Okay? That's an appeasement. But now the Korban Ola was rectifying the actual relationship. Hey, listen, I messed up. I hope that I gave back. You can see from just the paperwork, I fixed what I did. But I feel really bad, and I know I hurt your feelings. Can I take you out for lunch? Can I take you for a coffee? Or, you know what? There's a knock at my door. I open up the door. I see a car driving away. Oh, there's a bottle of really nice tequila. Hey, just wanted you to know I'm really sorry. And hope we can still be friends. Okay, this is the restoration of relationship. And that's not a small thing. That's not a small thing. Because what was happening was we saw a way out, a very, in a way, clinical way out of our mistakes. And we didn't go the extra mile to restore and to fix the relationships with each other. And then when that happened, God said something. That's the essence of it. What did I tell you? When does the atonement take place? When the Kohen actually eats the meat. When that mistake turns into material benefit for someone else, that's when the Kapora takes place. So if you're not fixing the relationship, and you feel as though I don't even have to fix the relationship because I fixed the problem, then all of a sudden God says, you know something, I'm going to take this entire thing away from you because you're misusing it. I'm sure everyone's been in this situation in their own way at some point in their life where someone did something hurtful to you and they don't even get it. And you try to explain it to them, and they simply can't wrap their mind around the fact that they've done something that was genuinely hurtful to you. They just don't even get the premise of what you're talking about. And on some level, we as a people got to that place where we just thought that the offerings were just offerings and were just fixings, and we lost sight of the larger picture. That it was a step along the way. Okay, so all of this is well and good, but now without a holy temple, what do we do today? So now let's get to the nitty-gritty and the most practical application of everything that I've been saying up until now. So the rabbi said something which I never understood until really yesterday. That's contained, like when I tell you now, you're going to go, oh, okay, well, yeah, that all this makes sense now. I hope you'll say this. This is how I feel. The rabbi said that now that we don't have the sacrifices, we have prayer. So that always seemed to me like, you know what? And now for the consolation prize, right? You know, there's an old W.C. Fields joke, which is like, first prize is 1 week in Philadelphia. Second prize is 2 weeks in Philadelphia. So, you know, it always seemed like, you know, like, oh, okay, so you're giving us prayer? That's what we get instead of the Korban. Like, how many of the 613 mitzvahs have to do with a Beis HaMikdash and Korbonos? Believe me, a giant number of the 613. So you're telling me basically our we don't get half the Torah or more, but we get to pray three times a day? Like a day, it seems like it's not quite balanced. Especially with regard to what I'm talking about, disentangling your soul from certain mistakes that we've made and situations that we've gotten ourselves into. How does prayer do that? Because the Chachamim are way smarter than me. And if they're telling you that the prayer works like the Korban, then if what I said to you before is true, we should see how prayer accomplishes what we just discussed. And it does. It does. Let me tell you something. When they say prayer, this is what they don't mean. That's not what they mean by prayer. Interestingly, tefillah, which means prayer, is the same gematria as shira, which means song. When the Chachamim are talking about prayer, they're talking about a very high level of idealized prayer, which, you know, thank God, I think that we've experienced it here on a regular basis at the Happy Menu, right? You've got singing. People are singing with at the top of their lungs with all their heart. They're dancing. They're really actually dancing. You're actually seeing tefillah in action. And I'm sure you've all experienced it at some point in your life. I hope that you have. So what happens when that takes place? Joy. And when joy takes place, what happens is that your soul comes out. Your soul becomes manifest. Your soul is no longer buried by your body. Listen to this. The Maharal says, when you dance, your soul has ascendancy over your body. This is exactly what I'm telling you. Tefillah, dancing, when David HaMelech prayed, he was dancing. So when you really pray, when they say, like, prayer is a substitute for these offerings, it's a level of prayer where your soul becomes manifest. Now, where a person goes for a blood test, they put in that thing that spins around quickly, and what it does is it separates your blood into layers. The heaviest stuff goes to the bottom, and then segment by segment, it rises and it all gets organized. This is what happens during prayer. Joy disentangles your soul from your body. That's what prayer does. And so in that way, you see very clearly how prayer and the offerings are accomplishing the same thing. Now, let me tell you something. When we talk about getting lost in situations, I just want to reference some words by the Lubavitcher Rebbe and apply them to Sefer Yonah. So, first, just a fun fact. When that storm happened to the ship of Yonah, it was only around that ship. All the nearby ships were on flat, calm water. Amazing thing that the Medrash says. Just around Yonah's ship was the worst storm that ever was. So everyone realizes that everyone on the ship is going to die. The boat is going to break apart. They're all going to drown. And everyone's praying to their gods and all the rest. And then the captain goes under the boat, on the bottom of the boat. He sees Yonah is fast asleep. He can't believe it. How can anyone sleep like this? Everyone's about to die. He wakes him up, like the middle of the night. He wakes him up and he says, "Who are you?" Now imagine someone woke you up in the middle of the night at 3 a.m., shook you awake, and said, "Who are you?" And you know what he answered? "I'm a Jew." See, the Lubavitcher Rebbe says that if you go up to most people and you say, "Who are you?" They'll say, "Oh, I'm a lawyer, I'm a teacher, I'm a doctor, I'm a mechanic, right? I'm an accountant," whatever it is that they do for a living. Do you know what that means? That means that your identity, the way you pay your rent, swallowed up your essence. This is another example of your soul getting swallowed by your circumstances. And when you're in a place of joy, if you go up to someone who's like crying with joy, at the Happy Minyan. Dancing, singing. Their cheeks are wet with tears, and you say, "Who are you?" "Oh, yeah, yeah, I run the coffee shop down the block." You'd think in a million years they're going to give you that answer. I want to tell you something. I want to just make it more real. Let me make it more real, okay? My wife heard this from her chiropractor, who learned it from her father. And she told me this maybe 20 years ago. And I'm telling you, these are words to live by. It's never too late to do the right thing. It's never too late to do the right thing. And one of the sharpest tools that the Yetzirah has, the evil inclination has, is to whisper in our ear, "It's too late. You had an opportunity. The opportunity is past. Sorry. You blew it. Had you done it a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, or a few years ago, then it probably would have worked out, but you kind of blew it because the door is shut, closed, and really tightly locked now. So just walk away, walk away." It's not true. It's not true. It is never too late to do the right thing. And I'll tell you something. I'm going to tell you two stories. One is much more amazing than the second one, but the second one involves me, so I'm going to tell it. This first one is that my wife's grandparents survived in Siberia during World War II in a labor camp, in large part because one of the close relatives from America sent a package with two snowsuits to Siberia in the middle of World War II, and it got there. Now, I could imagine and even forgive someone in America during World War II saying, "Am I really sending two snowsuits to Siberia in the middle of the war? Are you kidding me? These things aren't cheap, and whatever the postage was, and are you kidding me? Like, this is going to get to Siberia?" It got to Siberia, and it saved probably two lives. So I'm going to tell you a Gemara that's like really, it's one of the scariest Gemaras I've ever read. So it goes like this. It says in the end of days, Hashem is going to put the letter Taf, that's the last letter of the Aleph Beis, on the forehead of the wicked. And it's going to be in the color red. And he's also going to put the letter Taf, again, the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet, on the forehead of the tzaddikim, the righteous ones, and it's going to be the color Techelis, that's the blue of the talus string, which is supposed to remind you of the ocean, which is supposed to remind you of the sky, which is supposed to remind you of the throne of glory and the higher levels of heaven. He's going to put the letter Tav on the righteous people's forehead in this color blue. And then he's going to judge the wicked and condemn them. And then he's going to judge the righteous and condemn them. And it's like, what? It's like, go back a line. Did I read that properly? He's going to then condemn the righteous? Like, what? How does that sync with anything that I've ever learned about Judaism in my entire life? And then the Gemara goes on to explain. This is based on a verse from the prophets. Because the righteous didn't give ethical rebuke to the wicked. And then it says that the righteous are going to say, or the Gomorrah lobbying in favor of the righteous, challenges that and says, but the wicked wouldn't have listened. And then the Gomorrah responds on behalf of God, how do you know? How do you know? Maybe yes, maybe no. But you didn't try. And so we don't know. Please don't misunderstand me. I am not telling you this so that you should go and run up to people and start yelling at them to do the right thing. That's not my point. My point is that the Yetzer Hara comes to us and tells us it's too late. And what I'm saying is, but how do I know it's too late unless I try? That's my point. That's my point. How do I know it's too late unless I try? That's how I'm applying this Gemara, just so we're clear. And now I'm going to tell you a much less interesting story where I used this advice in my own life this past week. And thank God something wonderful really came from it. Okay? Now that I've given the end of the story away. By the way, advice to all tellers of stories. Do not tell the end of the story at the beginning of the story. You will completely lose the interest of your listener. I've seen very well-intentioned people tell the end of the story at the beginning of the story and then proceed to tell a very long story. And the other person just listens so patiently. And it's sort of like, yeah, okay, okay. So anyway, the point is, to make it short now, I had an interaction with someone very, very special. Without going into detail, someone very, very special. And I said that I would do something for them, and I didn't do it. I got overwhelmed with a lot of different things, and I didn't do it. And I kept on thinking, it's too long now to respond with what I said I was going to do. And then this week, I just did it, and I got the nicest response from the person. And already, two things have come from that interaction that suggests a vibrant relationship that I thought was absolutely lying in ashes. And it was just such a reminder of how the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, works, telling you that it's too late when it's 100% not too late. 100% not too late. So let me go into the ashes of the offering. There was a mitzvah to leave the fire burning all night on the altar. And night stands for exile. And fire stands for enthusiasm. And so, when energetically speaking, God created the fuel for us to survive the long night by leaving the fire on the altar. We should know whenever we're feeling like we have no energy, we're so stuck in the darkness, we're so stuck in the exile. Think about that fire burning all night on the altar and understand that that energy was put into the world for you at this moment. Not only that, but you want to hear something really interesting? When they lit the menorah, every day they would light the menorah. Now there was one flame in the menorah that never went out. But the rest of the candles of the menorah in the Holy Temple, they would light every day in the morning. Where would they get the fire to light the menorah? And the answer is from that flame on the altar. Now let's go a little bit deeper because there's a very cool idea there. The menorah represents inspiration, divine inspiration. Okay, it's actually aligned with Torah Shabbal Peh. and the flow from generation to generation of God's light, right? One of the deepest things I ever heard Reb Shlomo say is, when people talk about, like, did God give the Torah at Mount Sinai? Like, it's so many years ago, and it seems so abstract, and you're telling me God spoke, and, like it's so out of whack with just my daily life. Like, how do I understand this, right? So Reb Shlomo put it in a way that, to me, is so precious. He said, do you believe that God is in an ongoing conversation with the world? Isn't that awesome? Do you believe that God is in an ongoing conversation with the world? See, because if you answer yes to that, then you answer yes to 1,000 other different things. Because once I say to myself, yeah, of course I believe that God is in an ongoing conversation with the world, then Mount Sinai becomes completely reframed. It's like, okay. Sometimes he speaks quietly through events. Sometimes he just speaks. Right? Like Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz said so brilliantly. He said, for thousands of years, people spoke to God. At Mount Sinai, God spoke back. Okay. So divine inspiration flows through the generations, and that's one of the things that's symbolized by the menorah. The menorah is inspiration. How do I create inspiration through the fire of the altar? What does the altar represent? Actions, work. Through my work, I create inspiration. Through the fire of the altar, I light the menorah. Do you understand? There are a lot of people who are sort of part-time creatives. What's the difference between, like it says in this wonderful book that I recommend everyone who's interested in writing or producing or doing a business project or whatever it is, one of my best recommendations. It's called The War of Art. Excellent book, The War of Art. Very easy to read, very thin book with large print. Couldn't ask for anything more. And one of the main pieces of advice that he gives, he talks about the difference between amateurs and professionals. And he says, what's an amateur? An amateur is someone who waits for inspiration to come to them. What's a professional? A professional is someone who sits down in their chair at their desk for hours and brings the inspiration through their effort. Doesn't get out of the chair, day in and day out, till the light comes down. That's the idea that you take the fire from the altar, which represents work, avodah, and you light the menorah, which represents inspiration. Work creates inspiration. You don't wait for the inspiration. You create the inspiration through discipline and hard work. Okay. Now, I want to say something else. In the morning, there would just be the ashes from the offering that was brought and was left overnight, burned overnight. Well, now you've got some holy housekeeping that has to go on. So this was called, in Hebrew, Trumas Hadeshen. You would take the ashes, and it says that you would put them in a holy place. Right? You wouldn't just throw them out. You would take the ashes and put them in a holy place. Now this is a very, very precious teaching. I heard this from Reb Shlomo in the name of the Ishbitzer Rebbe. What are the ashes? The ashes are the distillation of the korban. The essence of the korban, the essence of the offering, remained in the ashes. Now that's a little counterintuitive, because normally speaking, when we think of ashes, we think that it's a representation of destruction. So do you understand how this is a very different, almost an opposite explanation of what ashes are?
Yeah.
The ashes here are the distillation of the thing itself. That which remains, not evidence of that which has been destroyed. The ashes of an offering are that which remains. And the Ishbitzer says, you take the ashes of that which remains and you put it in a holy place. Now let's go deeper. He means you take the memory of the beautiful things that you've experienced. Those are the ashes. After the event is over, what remains is the memory of the event. What do you do with the memory of the event, with the ashes? You put it in your heart. You make a special place where you catalog all the beautiful, special, holy things that have happened to you in your life, and you keep them in a holy place. I heard it referred to one time as U-4. U, the letter U-4. And that's shorthand for euphoric recall. Euphoric recall. Euphoric means just like ecstasy. A lot of people, they are very skilled at cataloging all the traumas of their life. And that is the narrative through line of their memory and of their self-image. This disappointed, followed by that hurt, followed by this catastrophe. So this is coming to uproot that way of thinking. This is saying, you take the ashes, the memories of all the beautiful things, and you put them in a special place in your heart. And let that be the bedrock of your memory. And that's easier said than done, because that requires a lot of rerouting of the neural pathways, which have become habitualized to remembering the negative. But it can be done. It 100% can be done. It's like exercise. Just like it's hard to lift up a heavy weight, but you do it again and again and again, and then you can lift up a heavier weight. It's hard to reroute a neural pathway, just like it's hard to lift up a weight, but after you do it a number of times, you reroute the neural pathway. So it's done through repetition and patience. And I can tell you in my own life that it's a years-long process. It's not I tried 5 times and it doesn't work. What are you giving me this advice for? It's a years-long process. And then guess what? It works. Or it's better than it was before. Absolutely. There's no question. I'll give you one last piece of practical advice. I have this on my phone. I don't have it on my desktop computer. I want to put it on my desktop computer. I had it at one point, and I can tell you, this is amazing. I don't know why they don't advertise this more. This is like a life-changing thing, okay? And if you can just figure out just what settings to press on your computer, you can have this today. You can have it if you want. As your background setting on your computer, they have a program which is on every computer, which will use as your background setting pictures from your photos. And it will cycle through your photos. And you will see reminders, not just reminders, but proof, actual proof of all of the good times that you've had on a regular basis. Things that you don't think about, that you've completely forgotten about that coffee with that friend, about that dinner with that relative, without that party, with that, one after another. And this is something that can help you to reroute your memory. Because there's so much fantastic stuff that's going on. And somehow we just don't think about it. And so really, really, it's terrific. It's terrific. It really is terrific. And psychologically, we have this term called reframing. And I have it on my phone now. This thing that I just told you about. And because the photos are larger size that you take with your phone, and your actual phone itself is much narrower and taller, what this program does, it literally reframes the shot. And it makes your pictures even better. Isn't that something? Like, they're even better than they were before.
Thanks for listening. We do this every week, so join in again next Sunday for our new podcast where we explore the amazingness of life. And review us and send in any comments or suggestions. I'd love to hear them.